Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks. We're going to talk now about a powerful drug that many people use every day. In its pure form, it's a white powder that gives you energy and focus. 1/16 of a teaspoon is all you need. Take a full teaspoon and it could kill you. The drug is also highly addictive. I know, because I think I'm addicted to it, and I know I take it every day. The drug I'm talking about is caffeine. Millions of us depend on it. We're going to listen back now to an interview we did last year with Murray Carpenter, a writer from Belfast, Maine, about his book Caffeinated, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. He began by telling us what got him hooked on the subject of caffeine.
As an undergraduate, many years ago, at the University of Colorado, I was a psychology major. And I did a paper for a senior seminar on caffeine and cognition because I was a latecomer to coffee drinking. I really noticed how it seemed to help me to study and to focus for writing and all that. I was also racing bikes at the time. My teammates and I knew if you had a strong cup of coffee before a race, we weren't scientific about it, but it seemed to give you a boost. Mm. So I thought I knew a little bit more than the layperson about it. And then when the controversy over energy drinks really started to bubble up, I thought I should look into it more and really try to cover caffeine as a beat. And when I did, I realized I really didn't know much about caffeine at all.
Right. And why is that? I mean, it begins at so many levels. I mean, you make the point that the Food and Drug Administration apparently doesn't know that much about caffeine, or at least they're not so inclined to think of it really as a drug that needs to be regulated, right?
Yeah. And we have to give FDA credit for this because there's really no parallel like this in terms of a drug that FDA would be regulating that you and I and most Americans are taking every single day. But yeah, it's fascinating. For example, there's not even a requirement that people who are bottlers who are blending caffeine into sodas and energy drinks list the quantity that they're blending into. And that's sort of the basic thing we need to know to be informed consumers.
Mm. So how would that work? I mean, would it be listed in grams, teaspoons, and would the average consumer even know how to read that?
Okay, great question. Coke, Pepsi, and Dr. Pepper Snapple have started voluntarily doing this. Mm-hmm. And it is listed in milligrams, and it's small, and it's on the back, and most of us would have a hard time because, you know, what's 35 milligrams of caffeine? It's hard for us to comprehend this. And some of the energy drink bottlers are starting to do this as well. So there is some movement afoot. And as FDA is assessing now the safety of energy drinks, I think labeling is going to be one of the big issues they take on.
Yeah. And why have they been so slow to do it? Because the FDA is all over the regulation of other things we ingest and put in our body. Why have they been sort of slow to get around to caffeine?
This is one of the things that really fascinated me when I researched the book. FDA, the predecessor to the FDA, the Bureau of Chemistry, first went after Coca-Cola over the issue of the caffeine it was adding to their drinks in 1909. Hmm. And this was a legal case that went all the way to the Supreme Court. And at that time, they were already asking the same questions we're asking today. Is it safe for children? Is it addictive? Is it different when it's added to a cola than when it's consumed in coffee? And what role should the federal government play in regulating it? And these questions linger today. And I think the fact that we all take so many of us drink coffee every day does sort of stop the conversation. If there's less caffeine, say, in energy drinks than there is in coffee and you're not regulating coffee, you know, how then should you regulate energy drinks? So it is a complex question.
Yeah. And, you know, I want to get to this question that I'm sure a lot of listeners would love to hear your take on, because my guess is a lot of listeners are like me, like you mentioned to me before we went on the air that you drink coffee. Your book has the subheading, How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us. So what's the verdict? I mean, are people who are hooked on coffee okay? Is it something we should unhook ourselves from? What's your view?
Well, the simple answer is if you don't experience anxiety, you're sleeping fine, you're happy and healthy, and you're a moderate caffeine user, which would be 3 to 4, often considered 3 to 4 cups of coffee a day, not monster cups, but
right.
Then there's no research that suggests you really need to cut back.
Yeah.
But for a lot of people who sleep badly, and that's really a high percentage of the population, and consume caffeine daily, I think it would really be worth experimenting to see if the caffeine is having some effect on your sleep.
Yeah, and of course, that's difficult, and that gets us into this conversation about addiction. And I want to ask you about this word, because you use it in this book, and you know, you call a spade a spade. We're talking about a drug. It's caffeine. We're talking about addiction. But I feel like we need another word here because, you know, I'm okay. I'm addicted to coffee, but it's not like being addicted to a drug where it's going to take me deeper and deeper and deeper, and I'm going to bankrupt my family and end up doing horrible things and, you know, God knows what, right? I mean, maybe we need another word.
Yeah, well, you really, you put your finger right on a really important point. You're not the first person to suggest that this really should belong in a whole different category than other drugs of abuse. But it does have the hallmarks of addiction, which is to say, you know, we develop tolerance. Most of us, even moderate caffeine use, we experience withdrawal symptoms upon cessation. And then there's, of course, a small portion of the population who would like to quit or moderate their caffeine use who find themselves unable to. So the issue of addiction, it's a tough word for this substance.
No, but it's fair. And when you say try to quit, I mean, I've had on and off in my adult life some issues with sleep, and I've tried to moderate my coffee intake. And I felt that headache on sort of the top of my head. So I know it's real. I know there's a real physical side to this addiction. So what about that? Do we understand why that happens?
Why we experience these symptoms when we stop?
Yeah.
I mean, the headache specifically, caffeine is a vasoconstrictor. So it's actually constricting those blood vessels in your brain. And as your caffeine levels are dropping after you've stopped, they're probably expanding and giving you a slight throbbing headache just where you gestured on the outside of your head. Which this is a very characteristic headache for people who are going through caffeine withdrawal.
I want to ask you about caffeine as a performance enhancement drug, and this gets really interesting because everything we read about with professional athletes getting into terrible situations, we take this very seriously as a society, and yet drinking coffee does enhance physical performance, right?
It does. And so I went to the Ironman triathlon in Kona, Hawaii, and followed an athlete as she raced, a professional, Sarah Piampiano. And she's one of these people who is using caffeine in very methodically in gels, and so she can ingest caffeine throughout the race. Caffeine at the same levels that you or I, moderate coffee drinkers, might use, is a very effective performance-enhancing drug. And for an hour-long race, it might give us an advantage of 1% to 3% over a non-caffeinated state. And this is exactly why it's so hard to regulate, because how could you regulate a substance that most of us are taking every day in the quantities that enhance our performance?
Yeah, really interesting. Murray, let me bring in another voice. Scott Kilgore is joining us by phone from Cambridge. He's associate professor of psychology at Harvard Med School and director of the Social Cognitive and Affective Neuroscience Lab at McLean Hospital's Department of Psychiatry. And he conducted studies in the Army comparing different kinds of stimulants, including caffeine, during prolonged sleep deprivation. And Scott Kilgore, welcome to the program.
Glad to be here.
I'd really like to ask you, because I was so intrigued, what you found with these experiments on military folks on how caffeine affected their performance and their ability to perform effectively.
We've been conducting studies when I was on active duty in the Army where we would keep people in the laboratory for several days at a time, and they wouldn't get any sleep. They'd volunteer for the study, and we would then monitor their performance. And we found that caffeine is an outstanding stimulant as far as keeping people awake, at least for the first and sometimes even the second night without any sleep.
So it's good at keeping them awake, but how do they perform while they're awake?
Well, we found that it brought them back up to pretty close to 100% of their baseline reaction time.
Hmm.
That was our primary measure that we were looking at, is a very simple reaction time measure. And we find that it brings people right back up to their baseline and sustains them that way through most of the night.
Did you conclude any warnings that should come along about using coffee and caffeine to keep yourself awake to do something?
Yeah, well, one of the limitations we found in our research was that it's great for sustaining basic reaction time performance, but it doesn't seem to bring all abilities up equally. It doesn't improve your judgment and decision-making capabilities. And so I used to give the example to my soldiers sometimes that, you know, taking caffeine may wake you up and you can, you know, point your rifle in the right direction and you're right on target. The problem is you may not be shooting the right target because your judgment and decision-making are not necessarily restored to the same level as your response time.
That's Scott Kilgore, associate professor of psychology at Harvard Med School. Murray Carpenter, is that consistent with what your research found? I mean, what I heard there was yeah, it'll keep you awake. It'll raise a lot of your sort of baseline abilities up to a pretty acceptable level, but maybe not all of them.
Yeah, I think that's a fair assessment. But again, it's worth recognizing that without caffeine, the soldiers would be operating at a subpar level anyway.
Let's take a couple of calls. Let's go to Steve, who's calling from Cambridge. Hi, Steve. You're on the air.
I drink about 4 8-ounce cups a day, and I drink it for stimulating my thinking. I also find that as a person who suffers from moderate, sometimes even more than moderate, depression, I found it very effective in helping with that. And a few years ago, maybe 10 now, I gave it up for 2 or 3 years, and I just found no benefit whatsoever to giving it up.
All right, Steve, thank you so much for the call. Murray, what do you think? No benefit at all?
Well, you know, he mentions a couple of interesting things there. There seems to be an inverse association between caffeinated coffee drinking and depression, but it's really hard to say if people who are drinking coffee are less depressed or if people who are less depressed choose to drink coffee. But in terms of the quitting and just not wanting to be that way, a couple of people expressed to me very much the same sort of sentiment, and one phrased it this way. She said she had quit for a couple of years, and she said, I just didn't want to live that way.
We should mention, by the way, I mean, I guess this is obvious, but I read it in your book and just sort of confirmed this idea that coffee is still our sort of caffeine delivery vehicle of choice, right? That's the
That's
way
right.
most of us get our
That's
caffeine.
Right. About two-thirds of our caffeine still comes from coffee, and so there's been a lot of growth in soft drinks and energy drinks and even in bottled teas. But coffee remains far and away our primary source of caffeine in the diet.
And yet you point out we're not drinking as much coffee as we used to, which sort of surprised me because I think of American cities as full of sort of more and more fancy coffee houses and espresso taps and so on and so forth.
Yeah, that really stunned me too. Everyone in the industry understands this well in the coffee industry, but yeah, our grandparents drank about twice as much coffee as we do. Coffee consumption peaked shortly after World War II in this country and declined pretty steadily. But about what you're mentioning in terms of the specialty coffee boom has really helped coffee to regain some of that market share, maybe about 20%. So we're getting back up there. But yes, we're still way below the levels that people consumed coffee 50 years ago.
And speaking of that specialty coffee market, what do we need to know about that? I mean, for the person who sort of tanks up at Starbucks every morning or during the day, what do we need to know about what goes on there and what we're putting in our bodies?
Well, it's a couple of things. For one thing, Starbucks, you know, a lot of people get a Starbucks Grande, you know, 16 ounces. That can pack a lot of caffeine. So we may not be drinking as much caffeine as a society as we used to, but we are getting some pretty big, strong servings. So one 16-ounce cup of Starbucks can have a lot of caffeine, and it varies so widely that it's really hard to know from day to day how much caffeine you're getting in your coffee. So,
now, why would it vary? Isn't a Starbucks Grande a Starbucks Grande Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, or Thursday, or that, Friday, Saturday, Sunday?
That's the exact question that Bruce Goldberger asked. He's a researcher who's now in Florida, and he went into Starbucks and he got the same 16-ounce Starbucks every day for 6 consecutive days. And one day it had as little as 260 milligrams of caffeine. Another day it had 560 milligrams, as much as 7 Red Bulls.
As much as 7 Red Bulls?
7 Red Bulls.
One cup of coffee.
One cup of coffee. And coffee is a natural product, and there just is going to be some natural variability in the caffeine levels in the bean.
How did we first start consuming caffeine to begin with?
Oh, that's a great question. The people figured out pretty much everywhere that caffeine exists naturally, people figured out how to use it. In Mesoamerica 3,000 years ago, people were using chocolate. Northern Africa, people started chewing coffee beans years ago. Again, probably around 3,000 years ago in Asia, people figured out if you brew tea leaves in water, you get a stimulating effect. So it seems to be one of these ideas that was just good enough that people would figure it out.
Yeah. Now, we're almost out of time, but your book is so packed full of fascinating details. And I was really fascinated by this. We know that caffeine is a naturally occurring drug, but you say that a lot of caffeine that's in our foods is synthetically produced now, right?
That's right.
By the Chinese.
That's right, yeah. Most of the caffeine industry in the U.S., we use we import 15 million pounds of caffeine in the U.S. every year, and most of that is produced in pharmaceutical plants, and much of that is produced. China's our biggest single source of caffeine, and again, it's mostly synthetic. You can also, and some of our caffeine does come from extraction from coffee or tea.
Well, it's a fascinating book, Murray. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about it.
Thank you. This has been fun.
That's Murray Carpenter talking to us back in March of 2014. His book is called Caffeinated: How Our Daily Habit Helps, Hurts, and Hooks Us.